A federal jury today found Boston mob kingpin James Whitey Bulger guilty on 31 criminal counts of racketeering, extortion, and conspiracy dating back to the 1970s. Jurors held Bulger responsible for 11 of the 19 murders in the case, enough to keep him behind bars for the rest of his life.
There have been a lot of books published in the past several years about this whole Whitey Bulger saga, but your new book, Where the Bodies Were Buried, is very different from all of them. Your book isn't simply about this now famous criminal and his trial. Can you talk about your approach and why your book is different and what it's ultimately about?
Yes, you're right. There's been a lot of books over the last decade, or really couple decades, ever since Bulger disappeared on the run. There's been a lot of writing about this. And it seemed to me, as I was up in Boston covering the trial, that something was skewed about the way this story has been covered over the decades. And that is, I think you can attribute it, in a sense, to what I call the cult of Bulger. The fact that Whitey is such a fascinating character, that all the focus has been on his personality characteristics, and an obsession with Whitey, which is fine, but it kind of misses the point in a way, which is that Bulger was in many ways a creation of the criminal justice system in New England. The use of informants, the informant program, which was created long before Bulger came along. Bulger plugged into that and wrote it for all it was worth, and used it to his advantage. But Bulger wasn't the one who created it. And so what I've tried to do in this book is step back a little bit, focus on the larger picture, to try to move the discussion beyond Whitey, the personality, to the universe that helped to create Whitey.
Right. And not only did you attend the Bulger trial every day in Boston, but you also became kind of immersed in his world of former partners in crime and his associates. What was it like spending time with these people, going out to dinner with them, men who were career criminals and, you know, men who had murdered a lot of other people?
Well, some of these sources I had known for a number of years. You know, one of the things that's unique about Bulger's story, for those of us who had been writing about it over the years, is that it went on for so long. You know, he was a mob boss for 20 years, and then he was on the run for 16 years. And really, it was those years that he was on the run that the truth about his years as a crime boss started to come out in court proceedings and many of the books that were written. And so this story went on for a long time, and I had been up to Boston in the early 2000s when I was doing research for a book called Paddywhacked, which was a big history of the Irish-American gangster, and I had begun to establish some sources up there in South Boston, and this is when Bulger was still on the run. And there was a lot of thought that he'd never be found or heard from again. And I cultivated some sources, local sources that were close to him. Patney was a criminal associate of his, also a rival. And Kevin Weeks, who was a right-hand man to Bulger for a number of years. I got to know these guys. So by the time I went up there to cover the trial, I had known them for years, and that's why you, I think, see the level of intimacy in the book, and that I was able to get that kind of time with those sources, because I basically had been cultivating them as sources for a long time.
Right. I mean, Pat, can you talk about Patney for a minute? Just, he's a pretty fascinating character.
Yeah, Patney's a great classic South Boston creation. He's a guy who was born in the old country in Galway, and then his family came over to South Boston when he was pretty young, 7 years old, and he had a lot of brothers, and it was sort of a classic South Boston family, and Pat fell into a life of gangsterism and crime at a pretty young age because he lived in a house that was overlooked this famous bar where a lot of the gangsters used to gather in Southie, and he became enamored with them at a young age, and became a thief and formed a gang called the Mullen Gang, which was basically a gang of what they call wharf rats, the guys who would rob the waterfront docks and warehouses in South Boston. And he went on to become a more prominent mobster there and did time for smuggling weapons to the IRA and later did time on an armed robbery charge. And he was a guy who never really liked Bulger. And in fact, early when he was with the Mullen Gang, he went to war with Bulger's faction, crime faction in South Boston. And later they became uneasy. They formed an uneasy alliance and became associates of sorts, but they never really did like each other. And so when Bulger went on the run, Patney eventually wrote a book called A Criminal and an Irishman, where he's very honest about his feelings about Bulger. And in fact, when they apprehended Bulger in Santa Monica in 2011, they confiscated the belongings in his apartment. One of them was Patney's book sitting alongside his bedside table. So the rivalry between me and Bulger continued right on through the trial. And it was sort of a sub-narrative to the trial that Bulger was trying to implicate me in criminal activities in any way that he could. And so Pat had become an important source for me. He's a dyed-in-the-wool South Boston guy, and he's been unusually frank with me about things that have taken place there over the years, and he's been an invaluable source for me to try to tell the story from the inside out.
And when he was captured in California in 2011, your books were in his apartment too, right?
Well, Paddywhack was, yeah, was on his bedside table, along with A Criminal and an Irishman. And I had also heard from an interview I did with Teresa Stanley before she died. Teresa Stanley was Bulger's common-law wife for 30 years, mm-hmm. and she died of cancer recently. But I interviewed her a few times before she passed away, and she was the one who first told me that Bulger was obsessed with the book The Westies, mm-hmm. which is the first book I published, and he would read that book and he'd pass it on to associates in his organization to read, kind of as a homework assignment. And she said he used to sit up late at night reading that book, and she'd be calling for him to come to bed, and he'd be reading The Westies. So, yeah, you know, all of that is, Bulger was a big reader, so they say. He read a lot of war history books, and he read a lot of true crime books, and you read all the books in which he's featured or mentioned.
Right.
So he was very interested, if not obsessed, with his image and how he was being portrayed in the public arena.
You know, throughout the book, it's pretty obvious that you weren't satisfied with the trial or the media coverage of the trial. And the juror who you became close to and you interviewed a lot for the book, she called the entire thing a travesty of justice. Do you agree with that? Like, what was the ultimate problem with the trial from the prosecution side?
Well, I don't know if I'd go so far as to call it a travesty of justice, but it had a lot of limitations. Some of them are just built into the law. Part of the problem was that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Massachusetts had very carefully orchestrated the case over the years so that it would focus typically on Bulger, and that it would limit sort of context and historical references and context about how Bulger came into power. Because if you were to follow those little tributaries, they start to take you into all sorts of layers of corruption within not just the FBI, but within the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office that it helped to enable Bulger over the years. Mm-hmm. And so that started to become apparent during the trial. I'm sure people who were legal advocates would say that it's not the responsibility of the Bulger trial to be a full and complete airing of all these other issues. But there's a few specific things about the trial where they could have easily lightened up or allowed it to go into those areas and but they didn't, and they were very strategic about not allowing that. For instance, Bolger had claimed at the beginning of the trial that he wanted to talk about how he had been given immunity by the U.S. attorney, a guy named Jeremiah O'Sullivan, who was a very powerful prosecutor, the most powerful prosecutor, and a crime prosecutor in New England. And Bolger claimed to have met with him, and there was some discussion about Jeremiah O'Sullivan feared for his life, that the mafia was going to come after him, and that he made a deal with Bolger to protect him. And in exchange, he was given immunity from prosecution. I think it's an absurd claim on Bolger's part, and it would have been revealed as such had Bolger been allowed to present that in court, but he wasn't. The prosecutors argued against it, and the judge stood with them, and so that whole avenue of discussion was not allowed to be part of the trial. And I think the reason the government wanted to keep that out is because who knows where that discussion would have led. Mm-hmm. Jeremiah O'Sullivan had been the head of the very office that was now prosecuting Bolger. And so, you know, there was it makes it seem as though there was a very carefully orchestrated cover-up of events in the way that the trial was presented to the public.
Right. The people I was talking about earlier who were his former associates who you became friends with and went out to dinner with and stuff like that, do you think some of them used the trial as an opportunity to kind of come to terms with the things that they had done in the past or absolve themselves in some way when they were up there on the stand?
Well, there've been a number of Bolger-related trials leading up to this trial. There was the trial of John Connolly, the FBI agent who was Bolger's handler. There was actually two trials of Connolly, one in Massachusetts and then one for murder in South Florida. And there had been other hearings and sort of public tribunals over the years where a lot of these figures who wound up testifying at the trial had testified earlier. So what happened at the, very little of what happened in the testimony at the trial was new information. It had been made public before. So I don't think there was an opportunity really to use that trial and to use the trial in that way, because it was sort of known what was going to be said, how it was going to be presented, and what the effect of it would be. Mm-hmm. But I will say that the trial was a media event, and it was quite a media event. In fact, maybe in some ways it was sort of the culmination, all the reporting on Bolger over the years, culminating with that trial. So, yeah, there was jockeying for position. There was a lot of propaganda being disseminated in the media. It was pretty intense for a public forum, an opportunity for people to try to get their version of the facts out. And so there was a lot of cultivating of the media. And, of course, there was a big documentary by a well-known documentary filmmaker, Joe Berlinger, mm-hmm. made a documentary about the trial, and it was shown on CNN. So it was a big public event, and there was some of that, but the opportunities for that were limited by the fact that the main points of the Bolger story were well-known by the time the trial happened.
Right. Was this your first time sitting in on an entire trial? Had you ever done that before?
Oh, yeah, I did that with the Westies trial back in the late 1980s. And I've done that with other trials. I don't know about the entire trial, but I've been in the courtroom for criminal trials quite a bit over the years.
When you did the Westies in the late 80s, was that a big media sensation as well, or it just wasn't as well known?
It wasn't as well known. It wasn't on the level of Bolger. The Westies had some notoriety in New York City. They were written about a lot in the tabloid newspapers, the Daily News and the Post primarily, and that had become sort of a media story when Mickey Featherstone, one of the prominent members of that gang, turned state's evidence and to testify against the gang, and that was sort of a big local story in New York. But the Bulger story had become a national story by the time this trial took place.
Right. You said in the book that the first time you went to South Boston was in the late 1970s. What was it like then, and what's it like now? I mean, is it even recognizable now from what it was like 10 years ago?
It's gentrified a lot. It's changed quite a bit. Although, you know, visually you would look at it, and it's the same neighborhood. It's basically the same streets, the same buildings, but the inhabitants have changed quite a bit, and the commercial establishments have changed quite a bit. Back in the 70s, when I was first there, I would say there was still a dark cloud over Southeast from the busing years. Mm-hmm. The busing years of 75, 76, 77. You know, I don't want to go into all of it, but basically the busing years were forced busing. A federal judge imposed a law that the schools had to be desegregated and that students would be forcibly bused to different schools outside of their neighborhood, and others from outside would be forcibly bused into Southie. And it created an intense racial conflict in Boston that exploded with demonstrations in the street, and it became very violent, and it became a national story with lots of images of white folks in Southie spewing racist commentary, and it created a bad image that Southie wasn't able to shape for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it also, the result of it was that the neighborhood kind of turned inward and became suspicious of outsiders and felt that it was being misinterpreted in the media. And so it began a period for Southie of insularity and parochialism. And so it was kind of a, you know, when you came into that neighborhood as an outsider, people wanted to know who you were, who you knew in the neighborhood. It really was not the most welcoming place unless you knew people there. So it had that mood and feeling to it when I was in the late 70s. And of course, I kind of fed into the Whitey Bulger years, mm-hmm. which were years of a kind of paranoia and secrecy in the neighborhood. And, you know, bodies were literally disappearing in the neighborhood. And it was kind of an ominous place to be during the Bulger years. But all of that changed in the years Bulger was on the run and had left South Boston. And of course, his brother, Billy Bulger, who had been a powerful politician, president of the state Senate, representative from Southie, he had gone into retirement. The Bulger years were over, and that cloud lifted, and South Boston has been in a state of intense gentrification ever since then.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of him being on the lam, during those years, did you think that they would ever find him, and where did you think he might have been, or did you have any thoughts about that at all?
Well, he was on the lam for 16 years, so my thoughts about that sort of ebbed and flowed and evolved over those 16 years. Initially, you know, when he first disappeared on the run, the general feeling I had was that the government did not want to find him. And that theory was backed up by the fact that they had assigned the very unit, the organized crime unit in the FBI, the very unit that had been involved in the corrupt relationship with Bulger was the unit that was assigned to find him. And so I suspected that they really didn't want to find him. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's a bunch of examples of they were presented with clues and opportunities that weren't followed up on. I think during the crucial years, you know, when they could attract Bulger, they really didn't want to find him. Later, you know, when he disappeared into the woodwork, and a lot of the talk was that he was probably off in Europe or some far-flung setting, I developed a feeling that he could have died, you know, and we wouldn't know about it. If he had been in Eastern Europe or something, and he died under an assumed name, and he was just some anonymous, you know, 78-year-old American who passed away with very little records to verify who he was. We wouldn't even have heard about it. So I was wrong, of course. I kind of felt that maybe he'd just gone somewhere and died. Mm-hmm. And we'd never know the result of it. But I should have known, because there were a lot of indicators over the years that his modus operandi for being on the run was to hide in plain sight. Mm-hmm. You know, he's kind of a generic looking guy in a way. I mean, there's not any real distinguishing features to describe about him that would make him easy to track. And so it was very easy for him to just sort of blend in mm-hmm. to crowds and wherever it was. And there was an incident, of course, that was Kevin Weeks wrote about in a book that he wrote called Brutal, where he used to meet with Bulger to give him fake ID that had been created. This is when Bulger was on the run. And they would meet in New York City, and they would meet in the middle of the day right in front of the public library on 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue in the middle of Midtown Manhattan, probably one of the most populated and crowded places in the world, and that's where they would meet. Mm-hmm. And that was Bulger's theory of the way you do it, was right out in the open with lots of large crowds. Weeks was worried about it, and he said to Bulger, we shouldn't be meeting right out in the open like this. And Whitey said, nah, this is the best way to do it. Watch this. And Whitey walked right up to a cop who was standing on the street and asked for some directions to a local building. And the cop gave him the directions. And then Whitey came back to Weeks and said, see? Huh. It's right out in the open.
So you probably walked by him at some point. Who knows?
It's possible. You know, I have a thing. When Whitey was caught, the first thought that popped into my head was... somewhere around 2008, I had a book come out called Havana Nocturne, mm-hmm. which was about the years of the mob in Cuba before the revolution. And I was doing a reading in Santa Monica at a Barnes & Noble on 3rd Street in Santa Monica, which is the exact street where Bulger lived. And there was an upstairs reading room at the Barnes & Noble, and there was a little bit of a crowd there. And as I was reading... an old man came into the place, and he sat in the back, and he had kind of a floppy hat on, and he looked to be in his 70s, and he sat in the very back row, so I never really got a very good look at him. And I noticed, I was in the middle of the reading when he came in, and I noticed this guy, and he sat there for about 10 minutes, and then before it got to the question and answer period, he had got up and left. I don't know who that was, but when I heard that they had apprehended Bulger on 3rd Street in Santa Monica, it was like a light bulb went off in my head, and I thought, was that Whitey who came in and sat down in the back row of the room and then left? I don't know if it was or not, but...
maybe it was.
Yeah, he was out there. Anyone could have passed him. He was not exactly hunkered down in hiding, you know. He circulated in Santa Monica... at a lot of sort of well-known tourist places like the Santa Monica Pier, and it worked for him for a long time. And by the way, the way they caught him, for those who don't know, was they basically by this time the United States Marshals had come in on the hunt for Bulger, and their strategy was to go after the girlfriend that he was with on the run with, Catherine Gregg, mm-hmm. because she had sort of a beauty routine that she used to follow, go to beauty parlors and get her hair done and things like that. And so they sort of focused on her, and that, in fact, was what led them to apprehend Bulger.
Towards the end of the book, you talk about how, you know, Whitey Bulger happened because of the policies that were in place to protect him, and nothing's really changed in that regard as far as, like, how... law enforcement deals with informants and that how that whole relationship works. So this is still going on all over the country, right?
Yes, it is. But this is an important point and probably the main value of the book or the main reason that I wrote the book. You know, the use of informants is such a central part of American law enforcement. And I'm not questioning it. I understand the use of informants, and I'm not necessarily against it. But what's happened with it from the start, really, when it was first instituted by J. Edgar Hoover, and then it became policy, you know, in the DEA and the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. I mean, everyone uses it now, the CIA, of course, the use of informants. It's very poorly supervised, and there's very little oversight, and there's very little accountability. And so these relationships often go bad. Agents become involved with criminals, and it's purposely left in a gray area or a dark area of what's expected from both sides of this relationship, money that's going to be paid, what are the benefits. A lot of times the criminals are sort of wilier and more manipulative and street smart than the agents are, so they wind up taking advantage of these relationships and using it to their advantage. And it happens all the time. It happens in the war on terror. Mm-hmm. It happens in the narco war, the Mexican narco war, and how that affects the United States. It's very common, and it's unethical and it's immoral to allow a criminal or to protect a criminal who's out on the street while they're still committing crimes and killing people. And that's what happened in the case of Bulger and his partner, Steve Fleming. They were protected and went on to kill a lot of people while they were under the protection of the United States government. Mm-hmm. And then when it became clear that this was going to come out in the public eye, there were great efforts on the part of the system to cover this up. And I think the cover-up in many ways is still ongoing. And I think that the trial was part of the cover-up in some ways. And so the system has a vested interest in protecting its reputation. And so it's not interested in full disclosure or telling the truth. So it leads into a whole dark area of the criminal justice system that's kind of shady and involves a lot of shady activity and things that shouldn't be allowed to happen. So I think that you can have informants, but you need oversight and accountability. A couple weeks ago, there was a report from the Inspector General's office. The Inspector General's office is a part of a branch of the government that's supposed to investigate corruption and fraud within the government. And they had done a study of the DEA and the DEA's use of informants. And the report they issued is devastating about the DEA's lack of accountability in their use of informants, and in fact that the DEA wouldn't even turn over documents to the Inspector General's office so they could do their investigation. And so their investigation reviewed a whole kind of corruption and willful lack of accountability on the part of the DEA, similar to what we find with the FBI and the Bulger story. So this is a problem. This is an ongoing problem. I think people need to pay some attention to this because it's undermining the concept of democracy. And if you had been at the trial and witnessed the statements of victims of Bulger's, family members of victims of Bulger and Fleming's various murders, and saw how devastating it was to people who had loved ones killed while the government was protecting the people who killed their loved ones, it was a pretty devastating and emotional thing to watch.
Yeah. I read somewhere that this is kind of your final word on the Irish mob. This completes the trilogy that started with the Westies, continued with Paddy Whacked. Is that true? And do you think you're kind of done writing about the Irish mob?
Yes, I would say for sure. I mean, I thought I was done writing about the Irish mob a while ago, but the Bulger story had legs, you know, for a long time, given the fact that he'd gone on the run. And here we were in 2011, 2011 is when he was apprehended. 2013, when the trial happened, here I was still writing about the Irish mob. I mean, the Irish mob pretty much disappeared somewhere in the 1990s, I guess you could say, when the Westies were taken down in a racketeering trial and Bulger was forced to go on the run. And the rackets, those in South Boston and in Boston, kind of dried up and disappeared. The Irish mob kind of lived well past its expiration date in New York and in Boston, but it's sort of become a non-entity by that point anywhere else around the United States, partly through just assimilation into U.S. culture and over the years. And, you know, the concept of an organized crime entity wasn't really needed by the Irish, you know, after a certain period of time. So it had just kind of died out over the decades. But it hadn't really been examined or written about, I don't think, until I wrote the book Paddywhacked, which was sort of a revelation to me and to a lot of people that there was this history and that you could write about the Irish mob, and you could see that in Kansas City and in Chicago and Boston and New York and New Orleans and other places, that there was a similar crime structure around the Irish mob, particularly, you know, the gangsters and their connections to politics, to the political structure, and to law enforcement. That was always kind of the triangle in the Irish mob, was the gangster, the politician, and law enforcement, and the interaction between those elements is what made the Irish mob. So, you know, Paddywhack was an opportunity to study that, you know, in a large scale way. But there was always that last chapter, which was Bulger, and the way that story would play out. And so when they captured Bulger, even when they captured Bulger, to be honest, I was resistant to the idea of writing a book. I just felt that I'd written about the Irish mob a lot and that others had written about Bulger a lot, and there probably wasn't much more to say. But it was when I got up to Boston and the trial unfolded, and I was covering it for various journalism outlets, Newsweek magazine and the Daily Beast website, and I just got the sense that there was the big picture of this story was not being told, that the fascination with Bulger, all things Bulger, the cult of Bulger, had kind of taken the eye off the ball, and people had forgotten that this is actually perhaps the greatest law enforcement or criminal justice system scandal of the last half century, the way that Bulger was handled and the fact that he was allowed to commit his crime while he was being protected by the government. So I think there was still room for that story to be written in a more comprehensive way.
Right. So speaking of the, this is my last question, but speaking of the cult of Bulger, Black Mass opens this week. You know, it's a high. There's been other Irish mob movies. You know, do any of them stick out? And are you going to see this one? And or maybe you've already seen a sneak preview of it. I don't know. But like, what do you think about this new movie coming out this week?
Well, I haven't seen it, and I will see it. I believe of all the Irish gang movies, there's been a few. Not so many prominent ones like The Departed and, of course, Scorsese's Gangs of New York, which is about the origins of the Irish mob. This is the first that you would, I think, that's based on a prominent nonfiction book. This is the first one that pretends to be based on true events and true story. And so I think it has interest and value in that sense. But it's based on a book, Black Mass, that was perhaps the first of the Bulger books to be published. And what concerns me is I'm sure this movie is going to feed into the cult of Bulger. And instead of talking about the degree to which Bulger was enabled by the criminal justice system, we're going to be talking about how good Johnny Depp's Boston accent is and a lot of, you know, trivia related to Whitey. But I hope that the the movie would open up a larger discussion about really what a scandalous is, that Bulger was enabled by the system in the way that he was.